You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the 11-day music festival, Milwaukee's Summerfest, begins next week. We'll get some advice on some of the best acts to see. Now, the New York Attorney General filed a civil lawsuit against the Donald J. Trump Foundation and its directors, President Trump and his children, Donald Jr., Ivanka, and Eric. The suit alleges, quote, a pattern of persistent illegal conduct occurring over more than a decade, end quote. The suit also alleges that the president and his children used the charity to fund parts of his campaign and for business and political purposes. The lawsuit seeks to bar the president and his children from serving on any charitable board, to dissolve the charity, and calls for restitution of $2.8 million plus penalties. Our next guest is here to explain what's happening with the suit and what it might mean for the Trumps and for nonprofits. Juliette Sorensen is the director of the Bloom Legal Clinic at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Juliette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Can you give us an overview of some of the specifics in these allegations in this lawsuit?
Sure. Briefly, the lawsuit, which is a civil suit brought by the New York Attorney General, alleges a wide-ranging pattern of illegal conduct by the Trump Foundation and its board of directors, that is to say President Trump, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, and Eric Trump. The illegal conduct includes a failure to follow basic procedures as a not-for-profit organization, perhaps more serious allegations of political coordination with the Trump presidential campaign and repeated and willful self-dealing transactions that directly benefited President Trump's personal and business interests.
Let's take each of those two points in turn. First of all, with the politics, there was a lot of attention to the foundation during the Republican primary campaign. The president had skipped a debate, held this fundraiser aiming to send money to veterans. And there's where it looks like members of the campaign, according to this lawsuit and according to emails they released, members of the Trump campaign were directing the foundation on how and where to send their money.
That's right. The campaign manager at the time dictated the timing, amounts, and recipients of money raised by the foundation to nonprofits strategically timed to coincide immediately in the days leading up to the Iowa caucuses.
And how irregular is that? How illegal would that be for a nonprofit?
It's absolutely illegal. This nonprofit, as required by New York law, was formed with the sole purpose of supporting charitable purposes. If there is a true motive of supporting an individual's political campaign, that's not only improper, it's illegal.
And then self-dealing, that's been a big part of this story. What does that mean, and how did it play out in practice?
Yeah, that's right. The lawsuit alleges at least five so-called self-dealing transactions by the Trump Foundation that were unlawful because they directly benefited either Mr. Trump or businesses he controls. Two of these were payments to settle legal claims. One was against the Mar-a-Lago Resort. One was against the Trump National Golf Club. One of them involved a payment at a charity auction to purchase a painting of Mr. Trump. Again, if these transactions are not for a charitable purpose, but rather to benefit business interests, they're not in compliance with New York law.
Talking to Juliette Sorensen from the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, looking at a lawsuit by New York's Attorney General against the board of the Trump Foundation, meaning members of the Trump family themselves. Juliette, this is a civil suit, not a criminal charge or a series of criminal charges. Why is that an important distinction?
Well, it's important in terms of the relief that the suit can seek. The relief sought here is very specific. One is to dissolve the Trump Foundation. One is penalties levied against the board of directors and President Trump. And then finally, the lawsuit does seek punitive measures with regard to those individuals, banning each of them from serving on any nonprofit boards in the state of New York. It seeks to ban President Trump for 10 years and his children, who were his board, for 1 year each. By contrast, of course, a criminal indictment could seek criminal penalties. That's not the case here, although the New York Attorney General did refer the situation both to the Federal Election Commission and the Internal Revenue Service.
Right. Does the filing of civil charges rule out future filings of criminal charges?
Not at all. If your listeners have heard of the double jeopardy clause, that only applies in criminal cases after one criminal case has gotten underway.
Why, stepping back a little bit, why is it important for the government, in this case, the government of New York, to oversee not-for-profit foundations like this in this way?
Well, all too often, non-for-profit governance is not held to especially strict scrutiny or standards of enforcement. This case was investigated by the Charities Bureau of the New York Attorney General's office, and it's important for people to know that there is such a thing as a Charities Bureau, and that nonprofits and the special tax-exempt status that they enjoy must comply with the legal expectations that they exist only for charitable purposes.
Is it common to see civil efforts like this, civil lawsuits or criminal charges for foundations and other nonprofits that end up being used the way they're not supposed to be for personal gain, in effect?
It's not the first time. It won't be the last. What is unusual about this lawsuit is that it doesn't allege one isolated instance of misconduct, but really a pattern of terrible governance. The board of directors hadn't met since 1998 or 1999. There was no fiduciary duty in exercising oversight of the operations of the foundation. Sadly, the foundation itself appears to be simply a pocketbook for President Trump.
I know one of your main research interests is the issue of corruption around the world, really. Is there, if there isn't this kind of oversight within an organization or from outside it, is there this potential for just a higher level of corruption?
There is. If you think about corruption and the dangers of corruption necessitating both transparency and accountability. In the United States, we have a history of charitable giving. We have a history of philanthropy. And for those traditions to exercise the important work that they do and to continue to enjoy the tax-exempt privilege that they have, it's very important that the board of directors exercise the oversight that it's bestowed with, but also that that enforcement bodies subject nonprofit organizations to their high standards.
Looking ahead, what happens with this lawsuit next? What which courts does it go to, or are these things often settled out of court?
This was filed in the Supreme Court of the state of New York. That's a slightly misleading name. That actually means the trial-level court in New York State. And it was simply the verified petition that's been filed against the Trumps and the foundation itself. At this point, attorneys for the parties will be given an opportunity to respond, and the process of civil litigation will begin. I'm sure that that the defendants will try to resolve this short of a trial and probably try a motion to dismiss as a starting point.
If this does go to a trial, does that open a process of discovery where the Attorney General's office could look for more possible evidence of wrongdoing?
Yes, it does. Now, if your listeners actually read the complaint, which is available online, they can see that it's extremely detailed, and it includes references to interviews and documents that the Attorney General's office has already seen in the course of the investigation leading up to this complaint. But absolutely, they would seek to depose the individual defendants leading up to trial and issue requests for information and more documents.
We'll leave it there for now. Juliet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Juliet Sorensen is the Harry R. Horow Professor in International Law for the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law and Director of the Bloom Legal Clinic there. She joined us to explain the lawsuit filed against President Trump's charity, the Donald J. Trump Foundation, by the New York Attorney General, what it could mean for the Trump family moving forward. With over 800 bands and 11 stages used over 11 days, Milwaukee Summerfest has been certified by the Guinness Book of World Records as the largest music festival on Earth. And the event consistently draws a variety of big-name acts and local favorites to the long-standing music festival. But catching a set from a lesser-known up-and-coming artist can make a music festival a truly unique experience. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music writer Piet Levy joins us now with some of his suggestions. Piet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, let's get to some big names first. Piet, you like to catch some of the big acts, and I know you've been picking some out. Janelle Monáe is coming this year. She's been big in music and movies. Tell us a little bit about what you expect from her show.
Oh, man, Janelle Monáe. If I had to pick one out of all 800 bands that I'm most excited about, it's absolutely Janelle Monáe. She's released, hands down, my favorite album of this year so far called Dirty Computer. It's just a really funky, fun album. She really emerges as kind of the heir apparent to Prince on this album. But it's also a very personal album, clearly her most personal album. She came out as pansexual earlier this year. There's a lot of sex-positive songs on there, a lot of Black Pride songs on there, a lot of political and socially relevant songs on there. Nevertheless, it never loses the funk. It never loses the beat. It's just so catchy. And she hasn't played Milwaukee in years, so I'm very, very excited for this.
All right, here's a little listen to the title track, Dirty Computer.
Dirty computer, breaking down, picking my face up off the ground.
Like to listen longer, but we've got a lot of other acts to get there too. You've got some country big names in your list. Who you got?
Yeah, well, here's kind of an alternative country artist, and he's really kind of in the same realm, but he's the one I'm most excited about in that world, and it's Jason Isbell. He's performing with his band, The Four Unit. He's going to be there July 5th. Jason Isbell was part of the Outlaw Music Festival at Summerfest last year. It was a festival within the festival at the American Family Insurance Amphitheater. It had huge names. Nelson was there. Sheryl Crow was there. Bob Dylan was there. And yet, set was the one that I thought was the most powerful. He's also has some really relevant new music from an album called The Nashville Sound with some really personal songs on there and a lot of really interesting political messaging on there, too. It's just he's one of the best songwriters we have.
Here's a little bit of Jason Isbell. This is If We Were Vampires.
Maybe time running out is a gift. I'll work hard till the end of my shift. Give you every second I can find and hope it isn't.
All right, we've had some out there space funk, some country, and then blues. You've got Buddy Guy on your list of picks. He is known for a pretty good live show, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Buddy Guy, he's one of the greatest guitarists of all time, period. I mean, Rolling Stone said that. Like, everyone said that. Anyone that's seen him said that. I think the last time he was at Summerfest, but certainly one of the most recent times, was he was the opening act for the Rolling Stones. There's this really surprising get for Summerfest where they got the Rolling Stones, one of the very few dates they did that summer in 2015, in the smallest venue, too. And Buddy Guy not only was the opener, but he also was a guest. The Rolling Stones love him for good reason. He's really one of our key legendary bluesmen whose music will live on forever.
All right, here's a little bit of Buddy Guy, Five Long Years.
Have you ever been mistreated? That you got to? You got to know just what I'm talking about.
Buddy Guy, and Piet, I know you like seeing the big acts, but there's a special place in your heart for catching the Wisconsin bands at Summerfest. Why is that?
Totally. I mean, that's the thing. This is the world's largest music festival, and obviously people go for the headliners, and those headliners are usually at the end of the night, but I always tell people every single year, get there early, discover things, and you can discover so much amazing talent that's just in our backyard. I think that's a great opportunity at Summerfest, and then you can find new favorites that you can see again and again and again in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin.
Right. Do you, well, maybe you do this differently than most people as a music writer yourself. Do you carefully map out who you're going to see where and when, or do you leave some time to wander?
I do try to leave a little time to wander. I mean, it's tougher for me because I've got so many deadlines. I have to kind of run around, and it's a big, big challenge. But I definitely encourage people to get there early to really kind of explore. You know, and you know, self-promoting here, but if you go to jsonline.com/entertainment/summerfest, there's actually an interactive guide that we have where you can find my suggestions for three acts to see each day. And those are broken down into like headliners, up-and-comers, and local acts, because there's just a lot of great local stuff you should check out.
Talking to Piet Levy from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about acts to catch at Summerfest. It's creeping up real soon, next week, in fact, in Milwaukee. We heard about some of the big names, and he's got a lot of local artists to tell us about as well. And let's get into some of those picks now, Piet. Abby Jean from Milwaukee. I'm not familiar. Tell us the story.
Oh, you should be familiar. Shame on you, Rob.
Well, and there's so much music like that, Piet, that I should know and I don't. It's the bane of my existence. But go ahead.
I'm just ripping you there. So yeah, Abby Jean was on the Journal Sentinel's Wisconsin Bands to Watch list for this year. She's just got this incredibly powerful voice. But, you know, it's not only powerful in the sense that she can really belt. It's powerful in the sense that there's just a lot of emotion to her singing. And she merges that with this really great rock sound that has this great backing rock band. This is an act who really, she can kind of reach everybody and touch everybody. I mean, she just has that big, wide kind of reach. I mean, I dare to kind of do some Adele comparisons in the sense that Adele can really, you know, whether you're 80 or 8, Adele can really captivate you. And Abby Jean does the exact same thing.
All right, here's Abby Jean and Be in the Sun. Abby Jean there, another newcomer, as I understand it, playing Summerfest, Milwaukee's Paper Holland. Tell us about them.
Well, kind of a newcomer. I mean, they've actually been around for a little bit, but they are, in a sense, a brand new band. I mean, they have certainly had lineup changes, but their sound has just changed really dramatically. Their first album that came out a few years ago is called Happy Belated, really good kind of emo pop that they'd worked on for a long, long time. And it even got a little bit of a national attention. You know, even NPR kind of championed the band a little bit. So they return with a new album called Galapagos, which is a very different kind of album. It doesn't sound like Happy Belated at all. It's got this more kind of tropical feel, but it's still consistently really good, really catchy, really absorbing.
All right, Paper Holland here with Silver Lines. Paper Holland with Silver Lines. I got another few. We'll see how many we can get through from your list here. A ska band here from Wisconsin, Something to Do. They've got some interesting song titles, Piet. Tell us about Something to Do.
Yeah, Something to Do is a ska band with members in Madison and Milwaukee. And we do this thing at the Journal Sentinel called Soundcheck, where we have local bands come in and do a couple songs on camera with us. And they did a soundcheck with us, one of the first ones that they did when I started here in 2012. And I just totally fell in love with their infectious sound. It's not necessarily original, but it's just really, really catchy. And those guys are just hilarious. Talking to them, I just kept cracking up. And they came back and did another session with us a couple years ago with one of their original Christmas songs. And you can hear it in their songs. I mean, they have a song about, like, Paul Newman. They have a song about Tina Fey from 30 Rock, her character. They have an Arrested Development-inspired song. They don't take themselves seriously at all, and that's part of the charm.
Here's that Paul Newman one titled Paul Newman Hates You.
He's getting pretty regular with Paul Newman. I talk with him a lot, yeah, I would say about twice a week, but it's normally the small talk with Paul Newman. But this is something different, this is something unique. So we'll call it, you don't want you about Paul Newman.
And Scott can be fun to see live, definitely. Let's see, how about Caroline Rose, an indie rocker?
Yeah, so let's branch out from Wisconsin and look at some kind of just emerging artists that are playing. There's actually something at Summerfest they've been doing for, I think, like 10 years now. I might be wrong there, but it's called the Emerging Artist Series, where on the Johnson Controls World Soundstage, from 3 o'clock until this last set to 6:45 each day. They have four emerging bands that play. And some of the alum have really gone on to do some really big things. Bourne's played there. Ex-ambassadors played there. Maren Morris, who obviously has that massive song called The Middle, she's an Emerging Artist Series alum. So it's really a chance to see some of the future stars, in the afternoon, up close and personal before they're huge, and you get those bragging rights. Caroline Rose is one of those artists who, I don't know if she'll be a massive star, but she's certainly one who's going to get more and more acclaim. Her latest album is just so catchy and so good, and it's a really good mix of kind of droll lyrics and droll humor with some really sensitive and somber subject matter, and the sound kind of spans from folk to, it's got a little bit of a pop jump to it. She says she was inspired in part by Justin Timberlake.
Caroline Rose here, More of the Same. One more, Piet. Second to last day, I understand one of your big picks not to miss, soul singer Johnny P.
Yeah, Johnny P is just kind of starting out, but man, when you hear his voice, it just brings you right back to Sam Cooke. I mean, he just has a really good sound to his voice and just a lot of passion to his songs. And they feel fresh, but they feel very familiar all in the same. We started the show with talking about Janelle Monáe and how she's done the music world and the movie world, and Johnny P is the same sort of deal. He's starting out with his songwriting career and his music career, but he also is kind of started with his acting career, and he got a really good start. He was in the film Detroit, which Catherine Bigelow directed last year, with Jacob Lattimore, who's a Milwaukee native, actually was in that film as well. So, definitely wanted to check out that July 7th at 8 o'clock on the Briggs & Stratton Big Backyard stage.
Little taste of Johnny P, Good to You.
Come with me, baby.
Yet, you're doing some workouts. Make sure you're in shape to catch all the bands you want to.
I'm doing what I can. I've got these three little kids at home, so they make me kind of run around a lot too. And I'll be running all over the place. We've got a whole team of people that will be going, covering Summerfest really extensively, like we do every year. And I encourage the listeners to go to jsonline.com/summerfest because we're going to have photos every day, reviews every day. You can go there now and get lots of pics for things to see, need to know guides, how you can get in for free every day. It's just such an incredible festival. It's always a pleasure to cover it, and I hope people will join us along as we jump right in again.
Thanks to Piet Levy from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel previewing Summerfest. In the background, Spoon, another one of his picks on Central Time. Now, with all the focus on immigration, Supreme Court rulings, and other items in the news, one issue that's been kind of under the radar lately is healthcare, but there's a lot going on. Just this week, President Trump introduced a new insurance option for small businesses. These businesses would be allowed to team up and offer cheaper, stripped-down plans than what the Affordable Care Act allows. Trump told the National Federation of Independent Businesses on Tuesday that the rule would allow small businesses to, quote, escape some of Obamacare's most burdensome mandates.
You're going to save massive amounts of money and have much better health care. It's going to cost you much less. It's going to be, I think, fantastic.
And earlier this month, the Trump administration announced that it would not be defending the Affordable Care Act against a lawsuit brought by 20 Republican-led states. That includes Wisconsin. Plus, members of Congress have various plans in the works, including a bipartisan effort to reduce premiums and a House Republican plan to cut Medicare and Medicaid spending. What does this all mean politically and for the state of health care in America? Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's also co-author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob.
Let's start with that announcement from the president, these association health plans. How would they work?
So association health plans have actually been around for a long time. They existed before the ACA. In fact, millions of people enrolled in them. And they're basically plans that allow small businesses, groups of small businesses, to pull together to buy insurance. So you could have a group of bakeries, might form a bakery association and buy insurance together. But before the ACA, these plans were pretty unregulated. And what happened was that plans could pick the states where they wanted to follow the regulations. And so as a result, they sold pretty weak insurance products. In many cases, the insurance that was sold in these plans covered none of the services that people needed, and it kind of became a magnet for scam artists. And many of these plans became insolvent, and what ended up happening is that you had a bunch of beneficiaries, I think over 100,000, incurred millions and millions of dollars of medical debt. And so under the ACA, it kind of changed the rules on these plans and basically said, we're now going to treat these as small business plans, and we're going to require them to cover all of the law's mandated benefits. So things like prescription drugs, essential health benefits, and things like that. And so what the Trump administration really did this week was to kind of go back to the pre-Obamacare status quo to allow association health plans to sort of be sold almost in the way that they were before the ACA, and that will sort of allow them to exclude coverage for things like prescription drugs, other essential health benefits, and also to sell plans that cover less than 60% of your medical costs.
And presumably they could offer fairly low, comparatively low premiums to the other alternatives that are out there?
Yeah, I think that's the cheers that you're seeing from, I think, both the Trump administration and from small business, right? He was speaking there at the National Federation of Independent Business, is that there's this idea that you're going to be able to offer plans that have much lower premiums. And indeed, some of the projections that have come out will suggest, that the people who enroll in these plans, and I think about 3.2 million people are projected to eventually enroll in one of these plans by 2022, are going to have premiums that are lower by something like 2.9%. And so that's the idea. For the people in those plans, premiums are going to go down. And so there's a sort of positive note that Trump is trying to sound there.
But the downside, you say, is that the coverage might be substantially less than what they might be getting from their current plan.
Right. And I think there's a real question, first, whether or not this is actually going to be something like health insurance at all, right? Are you actually going to have plans that cover the kinds of medical benefits people have come to expect are included in health insurance, including things like prescription drugs, the cost of which is increasing all the time? But the second, and I think there's a bigger concern here, which is that, and this is kind of complicated, but all of these people who are leaving the individual market that the ACA created and going to association health plans, those people tend to be younger and healthier. That means the people who are left in the individual market tend to be older and sicker. And what that's going to mean is that in the individual marketplace, for the people who are older and sicker and really can't handle those skimpier plans, their premiums are going to shoot up, and you're probably going to see some losses of coverage as a result of the policy change, right? So conservatively, I think the estimates from Avalere Health suggest that you're going to see about 100,000 people losing coverage as a result of this policy change. The other thing is, it's really changing the definition of what health insurance is, right? So we're going back to a sort of pre-ACA definition of plans that look sort of on the surface to consumers like health insurance, but in reality aren't really giving you a lot of the benefits that that you might expect.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University, co-author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act, looking at some of the big news in healthcare right now. I want to turn to another story. We might dig into those association health plans a little more. But there's this lawsuit going on, a bunch of states, including Wisconsin, 20 states with Republican state attorneys general, bringing this legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act based on some changes to, I think, tax law that the Republican Congress had passed. What's going on?
This is really complicated, so you'll have to bear with me.
I'll settle in, yeah.
This is part of, I think, the big narrative here, and it's related to association health plans as well, but this is part of a sort of death by a thousand cuts strategy for Republicans, right? So about a year ago, we were looking at Republicans trying and failing to repeal the ACA through Congress. And since they've not been able to do that, they're sort of taking whacks at it from every angle that they can. So back in December of last year, Republicans passed this tax cut, and one of the things they did in that tax cut was they zeroed out the penalty that people would have to pay if they didn't buy health insurance in the individual mandate. So they didn't get rid of the mandate, they just got rid of the penalty. So what happened was that earlier this year, after that happened, about 20 Republican state attorneys general, including Brad Schimmel of Wisconsin, filed a lawsuit claiming that because the Supreme Court, when it upheld the individual mandate back in 2012, it said that Congress could do this because of its taxing power. Now that there's no more effective tax penalty, the individual mandate is no longer constitutional. And then they took it one step further and said, because we're arguing that the individual mandate isn't constitutional, then the other provisions of the ACA, two important consumer protection provisions, first the guaranteed issue, the fact that you can't be denied coverage based on pre-existing conditions, and something called community rating, which prohibits insurers from discriminating based on age or other health conditions. Those also have to fall because Congress wouldn't have intended to create those if it didn't have the individual mandate. So that's a lot, a sort of mouthful there, but it's basically sort of attorneys general kind of looking at a political opportunity to make an attack on the ACA that was really set up by what Congress did when it made that tax reform.
And when I want to key in on one point here. When there was that failed effort to completely repeal the Affordable Care Act, one of the most controversial things it seemed like in public opinion was that pre-existing condition coverage. Not all of the Affordable Care Act is popular. That seems to be a popular bit of it. If this lawsuit is successful, and that may be a big if, that pre-existing condition requirement in federal law would go away. Do I have that right?
Yeah, the two things that really make it hard to discriminate against people based on their health status, for instance, the community rating and the guaranteed issue provisions, those would fall. Now, there are two sort of separate parts of the lawsuit. One is really related to the constitutionality of the individual mandate, and the other part of the lawsuit is related to the severability of that individual mandate from the other parts of the law. So it could be the case that they win on one part of the lawsuit and not the other two, but if they win on both, right, the protections that consumers enjoy would go away.
And then the federal government, the Attorney General's office, typically would defend a federal law. They basically flipped on this, right? They're not defending it anymore.
Yeah, so I will say, Rob, that you know I study the Affordable Care Act. I've been working on this for around 5 years, and I was pretty confused when I saw the initial arguments from the state attorneys general. But the Department of Justice, I think, threw a lot of us who studied this law for a bigger loop, which is that the DOJ usually defends the laws that Congress passes, and unless it can't find any reason to do so, right? If there's no reason in the world why DOJ would do it. And in this case, the DOJ is refusing to defend the lawsuit and instead, or to defend the law and instead filing a brief to support the state attorneys general. And in doing so, it's also making some kind of strange arguments. One of the arguments that it makes, for instance, is that if Congress wanted to sever the other parts of the ACA from the individual mandate, right, if it wanted to say that we still want these other parts of the law, even though we're getting rid of the individual mandate, it could have done so back in December when it passed the big tax cut. The only problem with that is that the tax cut was passed under something called budget reconciliation, and doing something like including a new severability clause wouldn't have been allowed under budget reconciliation rules. So there's some strange arguments in there, but the bigger sort of strange thing here is that the DOJ isn't defending a law that Congress passed, which is really from a sort of rule of law perspective, and the idea that we want to have sort of consistent application of laws that Congress passes, that is a sort of troubling thing.
Talking to Phil Rocco about some of the latest developments on the complicated politics of healthcare. Phil's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, co-author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Do you think Wisconsin should be part of this lawsuit aimed at repealing many parts of the Affordable Care Act, including the ones that ensure pre-existing condition coverage requirements? How hopeful are you, worried are you about health care and your own future personal coverage? Any thoughts or questions about these association health plans that small businesses could enter into under this new rule from the Trump administration? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the state of healthcare in the United States and the politics of healthcare with Phil Rocco. He's assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and co-author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. A lot going on, a new rule from the Trump administration that would allow groups of small businesses to offer cheaper healthcare plans with more limited coverage. The Justice Department saying it won't defend Obamacare in court against a lawsuit from 20 states, including Wisconsin. There are other developments out there, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about Republican efforts to chip away at the Affordable Care Act? Does the Trump administration have the right idea here with these association health plans from what you're hearing and seeing? What health care change do you need in your coverage? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Phil, big picture, if we change nothing right now, what is how are we doing on this complicated health care puzzle?
Well, I mean, I think the overall sort of picture that we're looking at here is a law that was passed really as a sort of pragmatic compromise, trying to maintain the sort of private system of insurance, really to satisfy some fiscal conservatives in Congress and also the insurance industry. But what the ACA has really done is it really has kind of satisfied no one. On the right, we've seen the right has really created a sort of political minefield for the ACA at every step and made this fairly moderate policy pretty difficult to implement. But on the other hand, I think there were a lot of folks in Congress at the time the ACA passed and even more today who really think that the compromise with the private means of providing health care was really not good enough. And I think that especially given the difficulties of implementing the sort of private portion of the ACA and the fact that people are still paying premiums and the price of services, especially things like prescription drugs, is rising, and the ACA didn't really go far enough to change that. I think that's left a lot of folks on the left in Congress and also a lot of consumers kind of cold to the ACA. And so there's a kind of push for doing something more, right, whether that be sort of Bernie Sanders' sort of single-payer approach or approach proposed by other Democrats and sort of liberal think tanks like the Center for American Progress, something called Medicare Extra. But there's, in a sense, still some it's not as if the Democrats are just sort of embracing this and saying this is the greatest policy in the world. We're done with health reform. And so the politics here are I think, kind of frustrating in part because the ACA wasn't sort of an immediate smash hit, you might say, with the people that it was supposed to be a smash hit for.
I want to bring on our callers now. Pat is with us in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Hi. You know, I've heard these conversations before, and we're all fighting a losing battle here because we're fighting against a Congress that's controlled by the Republican Party right now. And there are some good Republicans. I'm not saying there isn't, but Obama tried to do Obama tried to do a good thing. He had a good heart with the the fact that pre-existing diseases wouldn't put you bankrupt, and you wouldn't, because you got sick, you wouldn't have to give up your life. Those are all good things. But we all know that we can do single payer in this country. We're the richest country ever known to human beings. We're capable, very capable of doing this. But our politicians are controlled by money. Period.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Phil, he's saying he's making the case there for single payer. It's being talked about definitely in this election campaign.
Yeah, it is, and I think that this is one issue where a lot about when you ask voters what they think of it, a lot depends on how you of course frame it. But you know, there's been a sort of outpouring of I think support for some of the core ideas about single payer, the idea that you wouldn't necessarily have to pay anything when you walk in to the doctor's office, right? That's a huge sort of attraction to the plan. I think the other longer-term political trend is that one of the big barriers to doing major health reform in the United States has been people who have employer-sponsored coverage. And the idea is that single payer is this very uncertain thing that people wouldn't necessarily want to give up their employer-sponsored coverage for. But in recent years, we've seen increasing sort of cost shifting from employers to employees. Plans have become overall sort of less affordable for people. The price of healthcare services keeps rising. And so it might be the case that the long-term economic trends push a greater level of support for single payer. As the caller suggested, there is also a lot of pushback to single payer in part from parts of the both the insurance industry and the hospital associations and medical associations that kind of fear a greater level of government involvement and regulation. But it might be the case that both the economics and sort of public opinion is pushing in that direction.
I want to bring on one more quick call. Kelly is with us in Cascade. Kelly, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I want to piggyback on the prior caller. I totally support a single payer. I've been in healthcare, working in healthcare for the past 25 years. I've traveled extensively to other countries, and they put us to shame in terms of access to care. I think one of the biggest stressors for, you know, every normal family is, oh my God, you know, what if my family needs healthcare and I can't provide? And I work for a reputable healthcare company right now, and the deductible that my family pays is $8,000 out of pocket before we can, that's our deductible.
Kelly, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time, Phil. This issue isn't going away between now and Election Day, is it?
No, I think that I think you're seeing this in the primaries on the Democratic side, is that single payer is becoming a really important position that Democrats are having, you know, large incentives to take a stand on and sort of be on the right side of the issue, so to speak. So I don't think it's going away, and I don't think the issue of health reform is going away either. It's when you ask voters what they think the most important issue is going into 2018, healthcare is, depending on the poll you look at, number one or number two. So this is going to be an issue that we're going to be dealing with for the foreseeable future.
Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. We talked with him about some recent developments in U.S. healthcare policy, including a new announcement from the Trump administration just this week.